Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Daniel Paris, host of New Books in Finance, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm delighted to have as my guest today Paul Donovan. He is the author of the newly published Profit and Prejudice, The Luddites of the Fourth Industrial Revolution. Paul, thank you so much for being a guest on the show.
Thanks for having me on, Dan.
So I understand your day job, just so we're all clear, you are the Managing Director and Chief Economist for UBS Global Wealth Management. That is a lofty title, but you did want to mention, and I think it's clear for those of us who are in the industry that these book writing ventures are separate often from the day jobs. But in your case, UBS has been very supportive of your effort, but it is a production of Paul Donovan, not of UBS per se. Is that a fair summary?
That's exactly right, yes.
So, Profit and Prejudice, The Luddites of the Fourth Industrial Revolution, that title is actually kind of, the book, by the way, is coming out as we speak with Routledge, for those of you looking for it. The title has a lot of different metaphors in it and images and references. So, why don't we start with that and as a lead into the argument that you were trying to make?
Well, I suppose the central argument is pretty much prejudice is bad for the economy, it's bad for business, which is an argument that's been made since at least the 1950s. I mean, Gary Becker's very famous work on this. But what I am trying to say is actually we are running the risk in the Fourth Industrial Revolution of seeing a rise in prejudice. And I think perhaps more than at any other period in history, that rise in prejudice has the potential to really do very, very serious damage. Because the Fourth Industrial Revolution, it's mainly about labor and skills. It's not about the technology. It's the labor and skills which are going to drive economic and financial success. And if you are prejudiced, if you're a company that's prejudiced, or individuals, or a society that's prejudiced, then what you're doing is undermining the one thing which grants you success. You're destroying human capital, just as in the first industrial revolution, the original Luddites were machine breaking. They were destroying the looms and the spinning jennies and so on that were behind the first industrial revolution. So the prejudice today are effectively destroying the human capital, which is the key to success in this industrial revolution.
So one of the things that I like about your book as a historian who works in the capital markets is that you do have a clear historical sensibility as to what's valuable, what's key, what's the kind of the clutch point in any of these transitions in society. And we've had various, shall we say, industrial revolutions, where different things mattered. And it's one thing to just say that human capital management matters. Now, I get that every day through ESG investing. It's another thing to point out human capital management now matters a great deal more, because in the past, we've had these prior transitions in economic development, call them industrial revolutions, call them shifts in technology, whatever you will. But you do highlight, I think, for readers who may not be completely familiar with that, those prior transitions. Do you want to do a bit of an overview for them just to set the stage for the current fourth?
Absolutely. So, I mean, the first industrial revolution obviously was focused on the United Kingdom. really from sort of the mid-1700s onwards. And this was essentially about steam power coming in and mechanizing swathes of production, starting in particular with the cloth industry and then just sort of moving out from there into more and more. And of course, the issue with all of these industrial revolutions, and indeed with the current one, is that it's not just about the technology, it's about society changing. You get this enormous upheaval. You know, people who had been relatively high social status jobs suddenly find their social status collapsing because the jobs are being done by machine. And they're, you know, reduced to sort of manual labor rather than skilled labor in the first revolution. And that's one of the things which drives the Luddites. And you get the shift towards urbanization. But as soon as you get the shift towards urbanization, you start to change food production. And it's interesting that every industrial revolution that we've had so far has also had to be accompanied by some kind of agricultural upheaval as people move around the country and ways of doing things start to change. And then we have the second industrial revolution, which is more in the United States. There is also a second industrial revolution, obviously, in Europe, but it's more about the United States. And this is about electric power, essentially, and transforming the way in which business is done. The factory system, Fordism, the Henry Ford model starts to come in. And then the third industrial revolution is sort of in the 60s and 70s, and it's all about computer power. It's the microchip revolution. And this is something which creates upheaval for clerical jobs, where you start to change the way in which businesses are managed. You get flatter hierarchies for many of these roles. It changes the role of women in the workforce in particular. And again, you see wider social changes coming out of this and greater upheaval. So this is the pattern that we see. You get something which initially seems to be sort of a fairly narrow area of technology, but the ripple effects of this throughout society are really profound. And some people win and some people lose, as is always the case when you have anything revolutionary going on. And that's what creates a lot of the tensions. And in each of these revolutions that we have had, the first three, we have seen a rise in prejudice. And we have seen a lot of what we call scapegoat economics, because people feel, it's not my fault I'm losing my job. It's not my fault my social status is going down. And of course, on a personal level, it's not. You're turning up to work every day. You're doing just as good a job as you've always done. And somehow that's all being taken away from you by complex forces you don't understand. And so the tendency in these periods of upheaval is to look for something to blame. So it's not my fault I lost my job. It's the fault of the foreigner. It's the fault of the immigrant. It's the fault of this minority group or that minority group. And then it all becomes simple, because then you've got a single identifiable cause. Now, of course, it's not the genuine cause. This is all complete nonsense, as prejudice always is. But it gives you someone to blame. And that's why these periods of upheaval tend to coincide with scapegoat economics and prejudice. And that's always the tragedy of these industrial revolutions.
And that's what your book is trying to head off. I just want to kind of tie some of the pieces together. And that's really through the thread of labor, that in each instance, the common form or most numerically predominant form of labor becomes challenged at each transition from agricultural to industrial to service. And now, you know, who knows what the fourth one is, but it's obviously even the service economy is being transformed by technology to remote, who knows, you know, exactly how this is going to play out in the next couple of years. But so labor is challenged, the how people spend their time. And each time that happens, there's a friction. Cost is basically your argument. And those that are displaced are very unhappy about it. You also make the argument that throughout the book, that in each of the revolutions, the forms of prejudice that you identify are kind of bad, not just for the workers, but for the owners, that they're missing out on leaving money on the table, missing out on business opportunities that could, from a Becker perspective, profit maximize, which is a contentious point, which we'll return to in a moment. But also, I just want to say, it's not just from the employees' perspective who are being maybe outsourced or shifted, but also from management loses lots of good business opportunities, owners, because they don't see as neutrally as they ought to. Is that a fair summary of it from the management perspective?
Absolutely. And so, I mean, effectively from the management side, you have two problems. So the first is that if you are operating in a prejudiced society, or you yourself as a firm are prejudiced, you're losing opportunities to make money. So there are examples from the first industrial revolution where trade unions, male trade unions, came together to say women must not be allowed to work. And women certainly must not be allowed to work in this industry or that industry. And of course, that meant that you were no longer hiring the best people for the job, because if the best person happened to be a woman, the factory owner was not allowed to hire them. There would be riots, or the factory would be burned. And so you're obviously then missing out on talented workers, and that's creating damage to your profits. There's a fantastic example of this sort of blindness to the cost of prejudice in the United States in the 1940s, when baseball, which as I understand it is some kind of inferior form of cricket.
Will respond, trust me. I will get you back for that. Yes, proceed for now.
But the baseball was segregated, which itself is just ridiculous. And in the mid-1940s, the rules around segregation ended. And some teams desegregated, and other teams continued to be racist in their hiring. And the result was that the teams that desegregated won more games, they had more supporters because it was better baseball, and they made more money. But it still took years, almost a decade, for the racist teams to abandon their prejudice, because you couldn't just see beyond the irrationality and see that you were costing on every conceivable level. It was costing you good business support, money. So the first set of problems for management is around all of this, and the fact that you're just cutting yourself off from talent. But then there's this second set of issues that come in, which is around the diversity of decision making and the importance of having diverse decision making. If you have got a monoculture, you're going to miss opportunities, because you're only thinking in a certain way. And what's more dangerous is you're going to miss out on risk as well. You're not going to see the risks around the corner. And that's always the case. But if you are a monoculture in a period of structural upheaval, you're far more likely to do damage to your business, because there is going to be far more risk inevitably in a period of structural upheaval. And if you've got a monoculture, if you're stuck one way of thinking, you're not going to understand the changes that are going on in the world around you. That's potentially fatal to a business, frankly.
So before I push back a little bit on this, and I do it for the sake of argument and podcast discussions, not because I necessarily am going to take the other side of the argument, but for the sake of the discussion, let's go through some of the way that you frame the damage done in the kind of the second half of the book, from either gender perspectives, that you know, you have some very interesting stories of, and I'm just going to say, call it money left on the table because of bad prejudice in regard to either gender or sexuality, and aggregate damage done to the economy through forms of prejudice. And again, there's a funny, you have a very interesting, not funny, but important distinction in the beginning of the book between discrimination and prejudice, because the terms are interchangeable. And if someone is being, they're not interchangeable, but if someone is being casual and careless, they can be interchangeable. Being discriminating is a good thing. We all have to be discriminating. If the light is red, you do not go through it. If the light is green, you may, after being careful. That is being discriminating about your environment. Prejudice is something else, but it's worth highlighting the difference because prejudice and discrimination, negative, discriminating, positive, in a sense. It's worth, I think, clarifying some of the terms as we head into what is, in a sense, to some extent, political rather than economic literature.
Yes. So, I mean, discrimination is simply choosing one thing over another, which we do all the time. You discriminate between two things means you express a preference.
Coffee versus choice tea. One.
Exactly. Whereas prejudice is irrational discrimination. And that's the key point. It's the fact that you are not rationally choosing one thing over another. There's no good reason for preferring one thing over another, whether it's labor or product or whatever it is, any kind of irrational discrimination is prejudice. And of course, we are all prejudiced all the time because in a complex world, there is obviously a tendency to use rules of thumb. And a rule of thumb can very easily sway into prejudice. If you're so the example I use from my own family's history, as a Irish immigrants in the East End of London, was all Irish people are lazy. You can't trust Irish people, and therefore I won't hire Irish people. And of course, that's just outright prejudice, and not true. But if you as a 19th century business owner or a homeowner had hired three people, one of whom was Irish, and that person happened to be lazy, then you just generalize from that into a rule of thumb, and it rapidly becomes prejudice. So,
what was the geography of prejudice? I forget the name. Bethnal Green in the East London. What is the name of the area that you reference? Because an area where if someone said they were from that area, that they are a different type. It's a writing in the 19th century, a section of London that is
It's the East End. It's around. It's basically Cockney is the dialect, and so it's the docks of East London, and it's Stepney and Hackney, Bethnal Green, Cable Street, which is where some of my family were from, and they were considered a race apart. That was the phrase that was used at the time. They were a race apart, and of course there were different races in East London. East London has always been sort of this melting pot for immigrants because it was where the docks were. You sort of stepped off the boat and there you were in East London, but the idea was that these people were somehow subhuman. And that, of course, is one of the critical things when it comes to prejudice, is that people are very, very rarely prejudiced against people that they know. Because once you know someone, you know that they're the same as you. You understand that they've got the same hopes and fears and emotions and traumas and everything else as you're going through. What prejudice tends to rely on is the fact that you don't know the other group or you don't know them very well, and they are cast as less than. That's always the point with prejudice. A group is less than another group, and from less than to subhuman is again a very short step.
So your book has kind of chronicles anecdotally, but the anecdotes are sufficient in number and depth that it becomes almost empirical observations about the economic cost of this type of prejudice, again, in different types in different places, whether it's racial, ethnic, gender, through the last two centuries, both in the United States, in England, and mostly Anglo-American, just by the nature of your perspective and so forth. And so there is a chronicle of all this that this cost has, the cost of this exercise. You want to highlight some of the eye-popping stories that jump off the page when you were doing the research?
So, I mean, one of the problems, of course, that we've got is that there's no nice Bloomberg ticker you can pull up as an index of prejudice. And for a lot of history, part of the issue as well is that people don't like to admit that they're prejudiced. So when we do veiled survey techniques, which sort of bring out these hidden things, you find that people are a lot more prejudiced than they like to admit. And we see this, for example, or we have seen this in some American elections, the Bradley effect, named after an African-American member of Congress who always polled very, very highly and then would get about 5 to 10% fewer votes at the actual election because of racial prejudice, and people won't admit it. So one of the reasons I was very keen to use narrative economics is because it helps to illustrate the points, and people can see, without having to have a chart of prejudice, which is impossible to do, you can see some of these issues.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So, you mentioned just as an interjection, narrative economics. Bob Shiller has a book out by that name that tries to make that point about the power of stories, which can be hard to, as you say, pull up on a Bloomberg ticker, but have tremendous import. And an earlier review on the New Books Network was of his narrative economics. So I am very much appreciative of that approach.
No, I mean, and Shiller's work is fantastic on this. I mean, the book is a must read. Particularly now, again, with the way the fourth industrial revolution is changing our communication, narrative becomes, you know, as it were, even more important. But one of the stories that it just struck, I mean, it comes through the book in several chapters, is the history of the UK computer industry. So in 1945, the UK led the world in computer technology by years. America was at that time a very distant second. And the reason that the UK led, of course, was Bletchley Park and the need to crack the German Enigma code, which had required not only brilliant mathematicians, but computing power as well. And Bletchley Park is this fantastic example of when abandoning prejudice really, really works. So Bletchley Park was actually, by the standards of the 1940s, a remarkably diverse institution. There's this famous quote that Winston Churchill, when the Prime Minister, when he went to address Bletchley Park, as he was leaving, turned to his aide and said, "When I said leave no stone unturned in looking for staff, I didn't expect you to take me quite so literally," because you had mathematicians. You had members of the aristocracy. You had post office engineers who worked on telephone systems, who were suddenly the prototype computer engineers. Alan Turing.
People who did the Sunday Times crossword very well and very quickly.
Exactly. It was you want people who are capable of thinking around cryptic clues to get the crypto analysts in there. There were women, not as many as there should have been. That was still an area where there was prejudice, but there were a lot of women in there. Alan Turing was widely known to be homosexual, as were several other members of the team. And you've got this whole range of disciplines and social classes and gender, sexuality, everything coming together. And it worked brilliantly. And then after the war, Britain's advantage was just thrown away. And it was thrown away because there was a shortage of skilled computer labor. There wasn't the manpower. And that's the critical point, because there was the woman power. There were plenty of women who were absolute experts in the latest computer technology because they'd been operating at Bletchley Park. They'd been doing it all. And the British civil service said, yes, but when women marry, we prefer it that they leave. And so you had this situation where there was a real pool of talented women who were just thrown away. And there was an attempt to get around this. So there is a woman called Dame Stephanie Shirley, who set up her own computer programming company, which was originally entirely women who had been sort of thrown out of the establishment, and they all worked from home on computer programming, and it was a fantastically successful company. Except Stephanie Shirley, when she was touting for business, couldn't sign her name Stephanie Shirley. She had to sign her name Steve, because people would ignore a letter from a woman, but a letter from purportedly from a man, they would pay attention to. And so it's an example that the fact that Dame Shirley had this successful business shows how much was being wasted. But of course, she was just one woman. If the establishment had not adopted this prejudiced approach, then you know, the UK's lead in computing would have been maintained subsequently. Rather than thrown away with enormous cost to the UK economy, with enormous cost to individual companies within the UK and to the UK's government system, the civil service. I mean, the whole thing is just a tragedy caused by completely irrational discrimination.
Okay, and so her story is quite interesting. Takes up a good vignette in the book, and I happened to look her up afterward. She's still alive and well. I think older at this point and retired and working on philanthropical activities, but still part of the story, which is great. Your book makes the argument that, in sum, looking both empirically in the past and at any transition point, and we're now at a key transition point, and it's a transition point that is going to make human capital management even more critical. It's always critical, but even more critical this time around. This is a way of leaving a lot of money on the table. It is irrational. That is your summary argument, and you summarize it and such. You know, it's just bad for business, the old phrase. And I want to push back a little bit on Gary Becker and the University of Chicago, and it's bad for business, not in favor of prejudice, but in favor of the fact that human beings, particularly with all the literature on behavioral finance that has come to light post-Becker, post-Chicago, though it's now also in Chicago, that you know we now know that behaving irrationally in economic matters, not destructively, but irrationally, is par for the course. Matter of fact, it's far more common than behaving rationally. Behaving rationally in business matters is probably a minority occurrence. We all aim for it, but you know, if we hit it as a majority, then that's quite exceptional. And that some people in divided societies, the United States is unfortunately a perfect example of that right now. So you know what? I don't care. I'm going to leave some money on the table. I don't want to do business with this person, or I don't want to invest in this. There is a famous Supreme Court case about bakers of a cake who didn't want to serve a certain clientele, but the civil rights legislation would have compelled them to do so. There was a court case. I literally don't know how it came out, and I should, but it doesn't matter. The point was that someone said, I am willing, from the perspective of this book, the baker said, I am not interested in their business. It opens up a perspective that there will be people who will say, you know, yeah, maybe it's less efficient, maybe it's less whatever, but I have my preferences. They may probably wouldn't call them prejudices, but I have my preferences. I have my community, and I'm not profit maximizing. I never went to the University of Chicago. I never got the memo about profit maximization, and that just telling them, hey, you're being irrational, you could leave more money, you could, you know, this could be a bigger enterprise or more profitable, is going to appeal to a lot of people, but it's going to also not appeal to a large, maybe minority or a large segment of the population. What do you say to that kind of pushback?
Well, I mean, this, Becker did mention this, that there will be your business owners that say, no, I am prepared to pay the price. And there will be customers who say, you know, I will accept inferior quality goods or inferior quality service because I am prejudiced. And you can have employees who will accept effectively lower wages because they are prejudiced. So yes, you can have that. But what is the problem with that? Well, the problem with that is that if you are exhibiting prejudice, it's not just that you're damaging your business, you're actually damaging other people. The targets of prejudice become damaged by this. And we see this time and time again, that if you are being told by one group in society, no, you're less than, then you'll stop trying. Because why would you try? You can't, you're never going to succeed. You're never going to be able to beat the system. Or you will change your behavior in a way which leads to more negative outcomes. So the issue here, I think, is that you may well have a firm saying, well, no, I'm going to be prejudiced and I accept that there's a cost to me personally. But what you are also doing is inflicting a cost on society, because you are helping to undermine potential skills. You're helping to prevent people from reaching their full potential through the act of being prejudiced yourself. And that is, again, can be particularly damaging over time, and you start to do real damage to the wider economy overall. So you have, it doesn't matter what the prejudice is. Racial prejudices and gender prejudice obviously tend to be very big ones because you're dealing with relatively large communities in many societies here. And if you're creating a situation where a group feel that certain careers are not open to them or certain aspects of business are not open to them, then they are going to change and modify their behavior in a way that is detrimental to everybody, not just to the business owner deciding, well, hey, I'm going to give up 5% of my profits or whatever it is.
I get your point. I don't disagree with any of that. I think we then fall into the difference between microeconomics and macroeconomics. A lot of people will say, in that minority of prejudiced agents in an economy, will say, the macroeconomic damage may be done, but I don't care because it doesn't. I can quantify the micro damage to my business, but I at least near term. But I just don't care about the rest. I just think it is asking for a degree of, again, this is basically back to behavioral finance or behavioral economics, asking for a degree of rationality among a large portion of the population. All of the population that struggles with rationality on good days and much of the time really struggles with it. Your book is so timely. It was written, I assume, over the last couple of years. I think you said 4 years, but the United States is an example. And to some extent, England is just incredibly divided right now. And with people having their own sets of facts and their own narratives and their own definitions of what good and bad and prejudice and even profit might be. So it's timely, but it's a very difficult argument. You do have a chapter nicely titled Fighting Back, where you try to, kind of work on bridging these gaps to the extent possible. Again, I think the work is, you've got your work cut out for you, but you want to discuss what you think are mechanisms for overcoming the economic prejudice.
So, I think it is fighting back. I'm very clear in the book. I think prejudice is going to rise in the next few years because of the nature of structural change. And that for me as an economist, as I'm trying to identify the winners and losers of the fourth industrial revolution, when I'm looking at a company or when I'm looking at a society, it is the society or company that is fighting back most effectively against prejudice that is most likely to become a winner in this situation. So that's it's not denying that prejudice is going to rise. So how do you fight back? So I think that there is the role of education is very important. Now, I fully admit that I wouldn't say prejudiced, I am biased on education. Education is very, very important to me personally. I'm what we in the UK at least call first generation. That is to say, I was the first member of my family to go to university. It made a huge difference to me. My father, incidentally, was the second person in our family to go to university. He
good,
went after he retired.
Him.
Absolutely. Very, and
that's
absolutely
a wonderful story.
It.
That's a great story.
So the value of education, I think, is twofold. Firstly, if you're educated properly, you acquire a flexibility. So the idea that you get your degree by memorizing a textbook, I'm very sorry to say, if you have got your degree by memorizing a textbook, you are a low-skilled worker and you don't have much of a future in the fourth industrial revolution because the textbook is going to be torn up in the midst of all this structural change. But if you have learnt rather than being taught, if you have acquired skills which enable you to continue learning over time, then you are going to be able to adapt far more readily to the structural changes that are coming ahead. And that therefore reduces the risk of you falling into scapegoat economics because you're able to adapt to circumstances change. And then secondly, I think there's educating ourselves about other people, educating ourselves about minority groups and learning about other people. Because as I said earlier on, you're very unlikely to be prejudiced against somebody you know, because you know that they're not particularly different from you. You know that they're not less than. And so that too is a way, I think, of very much helping with the fighting back. And this is one of the areas where technology, I think, does help. It's also a negative, but don't get me wrong, technology is also making prejudice worse. But prejudice can be fought with technology, because what we find here is the combination of parasocial theory and contact theory. So contact theory is this idea that if you know people from a different group, you're not likely to be prejudiced against them. And parasocial theory is this idea that people form a sort of friendship with people that they see on television or they hear on the radio on a regular basis. And it came out in the 1930s. There was a US radio soap opera called The Goldbergs, which was later became a TV show and was about a Jewish family in New York. And it was broadcast regularly, and it did a lot to reduce anti-Semitism in the United States, because people would tune into this radio soap opera and they would sort of form an emotional attachment, because you're getting emotionally invested in the characters. And you're hearing about them on a daily basis, and you're hearing about their lives and, you know, the loves and traumas and all the rest of it. And so you become almost friends with them. And then that goes on with television programs. As I say in the book, everybody knows somebody like Monica Geller. You know, the Friends franchise, actually people became involved and emotionally attached to these characters. And now with technology, it becomes even more like that, that you are able to listen to podcasts, you are you're able to follow people on YouTube or Twitter or TikTok, which I still don't understand, but people form bonds with these people. And of course, it's more likely to be a two-way process, whereby you can interact in the comments section or on Discord or whatever with the people that you're listening to, and you get that emotional attachment far, far more strongly. And that, I think, also does help fight prejudice, because if you are listening to a podcast from somebody who's from a different group to you, and you're interacting with them in the comment section or whatever it is, then over time, you get that sort of contact, which helps challenge your prejudice, reduce your prejudice. Probably doesn't reduce it to zero, but if it chips it away at it, that's all you need.
What about what we're seeing a great deal in technology now? And again, I don't want to go down this rabbit hole as we're kind of nearing completion. But the United States currently is so divided. What's clear is that media is also divided, and evident to me that my media universe, including online and offline media, is so dramatically different than other. I'm not interacting, shall we say, with the other side at all.
Yep.
And that's self-selecting. There are a few points of overlap. I try to watch the BBC to get a neutral perspective, but even the BBC is not perfectly neutral. And I don't know that the two sides in the United States are actually interacting with each other through technology at this point. Instead, they've created not hermetically sealed, but substantially sealed communities, which amplify and concur with one another their already existing attitudes they had coming into the equation. So you got your work cut out for you. I think this is the technology said can both ways. It can provide bridges, but it also can provide walls to some extent, that at least the way it's being played out in the United States at the present time.
Well, and one of the things that we need to remember, of course, is that whilst technology is very good at bringing minority groups together, so you can create virtual communities, particularly in things like sexuality or disability, which are just genetically roughly evenly distributed across a country. And so you've got the potential targets of prejudice who can come together online. And that's absolutely fantastic for these minority groups. But what we need to remember is that the extremists, the extremely prejudiced, are also a minority group. And they use technology just as well. And I did quite a lot of research into white supremacist movements, which was probably the most depressing 2 months of the sort of 4.5 years I was researching this book, because they are flourishing using exactly the same technology that is helping other minorities, the persecuted and the persecutors both get the advantage of this. And as you say, you know, we also get this echo chamber that we tend to only hear the news that we like to hear unless we make a very conscious effort to sort of broaden our horizons and so forth. There are, I think, some mitigating factors to this that, you know, when we're talking about things like contact theory, particularly with the younger generation, you may be forming social networks and friendship groups online that are away from the news. So you might have, you know, people that you bond with over a television program, as in a drama program or something like that, or you may be gaming with people from different backgrounds. And of course, the great thing about this is that a lot of the time, if you are interacting with somebody in a chat room or online, you're talking to a pseudonym, you're talking to an avatar. So you don't know their nationality, you don't know their gender, you don't know their sexuality, you don't know their racial or religious background. You're just forming a friendship with them. And that is a way of challenging some of these barriers, but it's outside of the news flow. Within the news flow, you run the risk of the echo chamber, and that can be quite a big problem. But I think for the younger generation, there is this potential to benefit from the anonymity that online can sometimes provide and help to challenge prejudice. It's not perfect, and there are some examples of prejudice in the younger generation that I give in the book, but generally speaking, the younger generation is less prejudiced than older generations are. If you look at the World Values Survey, that's been true for several years. So there are grounds for optimism, but we shouldn't underestimate the task ahead.
Let's end on that high note in an otherwise, as you say, kind of a challenging overall environment, that technology will create a means of net positive on the fighting back, and both good for society, good for individuals, and for the economics. The book is Profit and Prejudice, The Luddites of the Fourth Industrial Revolution. Paul Donovan, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much for your time, Dan.